Content should not be discussed in public meeting. Be advised that upon a vote of the majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session to discuss any confidential records or to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney. For today, there's one complaint scheduled, number T-22-04 against Ms. Kristen Jones. Dr. Davis Wilson is the lead committee member for the complaint. Would you provide the committee an overview of the complaint, Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. of course, my notes froze. All right, so on, I apologize, December 14th, 2021, board staff did send an email notifying Ms. Jones of the complaint. So what was noted in the complaint is that we did have concerns about a potential practice of behavior analysis without a license. This would be a potential violation of ARS 32-2091.12, which prohibits the use of any words, initials, or symbols that leads the public to believe that a person making this representation is licensed to practice behavior analysis in Arizona. It was noted through an application review of MW on July 30th, 2021, that her licensure was done remotely from Ms. Jones, who is currently licensed in Tennessee, but not licensed in Arizona. After review of the application, it was determined that MW was required to redo some of her hours in order to obtain licensure, as she was not able to count the non-licensed hours. During that time, board staff did notify both MW and the supervisor that it would be of concern. When we reviewed the application, Ms. Jones indicated by email that she was not nor had ever practiced in the state of Arizona, and that she is a Tennessee licensed behavior analyst who provides remote supervision for BCBA licensure. During that meeting, we did determine that we wanted to look further into the potential unlicensed practice of behavior analysis that may have been conducted at the time of MW supervision and or other matters that could have occurred with regards to supervision from Ms. Jones. Ms. Jones did respond to the complaint in a timely manner. She acknowledged that she was the supervisor for MW, and that she was not clear that that would be a problem, and that she has since ceased any practice of supervision in Arizona. And I believe that concludes the summary of this complaint.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. The complaint was opened by the board, so there is no complaint. Ms. Jones, I noticed you're on the call. If you would please state your full name for the record. You have the opportunity now to make a brief statement to the committee, up to 5 minutes. The committee may have some questions following your statement. So, Ms. Jones, would you like to make any statements?
Yeah, I'm Kristen Jones. And I've written out a statement, if you guys don't mind me reading it. I'm not great at public speaking, so.
Not at all. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I did provide supervision to MW via remote supervision. And at that time, she was living in Arizona, which is why the state was indicated on her supervision forms. At the time of her supervision, I was unaware that the supervision had to be provided by an Arizona licensed BCBA. Had I been aware of the matter, I would not have provided supervision to the supervisee. I can assure you that this situation was unintended. The supervision was provided out of Tennessee, where I hold a state license. The supervision was remote only, and I had no way intended to impersonate an Arizona licensed BCBA. I hope that this response conveys a clear message of the unintentional error that was made on my part. My lack of knowledge of the Board of Psychological Examiner's requirements has put me in a position or in this position, and I understand fully the board's need to resolve this complaint matter. Additionally, as I review the BACB ethical guidelines, I'm now understanding that it was both the supervisee and the supervisor's responsibility to gain knowledge of our state's limitations as well as Arizona's limitations prior to signing a contract with the supervisee. I appreciate you bringing the ethical issue to my attention as I navigate my role as a BCBA supervisor. Additionally, I will seek additional ethics CEUs in the future in order to educate myself further.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jones. Committee, any questions for Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chair, I do have a few, and I will make them brief, and they're probably going to be a combination of kind of education and questions. My first question is related to Ms. Jones, your current website. It's listed that you are practicing behavior analysis remotely. Other than providing services, supervision services for MW, have you provided supervision for any other applicants in the state of Arizona?
No, ma'am.
Thank you. And then my other question was, as far as kind of your role of supervision and what supervision is, as far as the direct client that's receiving and benefiting services, have you taken a time to reflect on not just simply that, on our board, yes, licensure is required for the applicant to be eligible for licensure, but also the services that a supervisee is providing are behavior analytics services to an individual. And then the services you as a supervisor are providing are behavior analytics services to an individual that resides in a state that requires licensure. Have you done any reflection on kind of what that might mean as far as practicing in a state that requires licensure?
Okay, I think I'm going to answer your question correctly. I have. I think this specific situation has educated me on the limitations of my state license as well as my board certification license. I do not anticipate providing supervision services in the state of Arizona without gaining an Arizona license first. Did that answer the question?
It did. And I appreciate that. And so I'm just going to take a moment to talk just briefly about the fact that Arizona's license is actually not unique. In fact, the practice and title law that we have exists in the larger majority of states that have licensure. I think there are a small handful, maybe four or five offhand, I can think of Texas as being one of them, that actually explicitly excludes supervision from their licensing requirements. And so the reason why I bring this up is because while it might appear that you're in this situation with Arizona, I really would encourage you to look at other states in which you might be providing remote supervision and kind of think about how states that have these practice and title acts might interpret supervision from a stance of practice, and perhaps even reach out to those states and educate yourself before the practice. So I do hear, and I appreciate that that's something that you're going to do for Arizona. But as just a fellow colleague and somebody who is very passionate about educating around this particular concern, is that the reality of it is this could be the same for me if I were to practice in Tennessee. In fact, Tennessee's law is written very similar to Arizona's. So I couldn't do remote supervision in your state without having been licensed first. And so I just bring that up because it does appear that remote supervision seems to be an area of expertise or interest of yours. And so I just really think that it would be behoove of you to go through all of the states and potentially educate yourself on those variations, and then make sure that you're very clear when you take on those new supervisees that multiple states, like I said, the larger majority of the states actually do have practice and title acts that may affect supervision. And absolutely. I have no other questions. I just wanted to take that opportunity to say that.
Absolutely. I completely understand. And I appreciate you bringing it to my attention that multiple states have a similar clause as Arizona. To be honest, I wasn't aware of it until this situation, and I will do my due diligence in the future.
Dr. David, did you have a comment?
I'm going to continue with Dr. Davis Wilson's kind of discussion here. I mean, it's more of a discussion with Ms. Jones than anything. I think that, given your location and the surrounding states around you, almost all of them have a licensure act in place that is similar to Arizona. And we are now approaching 33, I believe, soon to be 34 states that are going to have licensure in place for behavior analysts. And so, along the same lines as Dr. Davis Wilson, if you are going to continue with tele or remote supervision, it's going to go probably beyond due diligence. It's probably going to require you to be able to say that you're able to provide that service to someone, or you will revisit this issue with other state boards, undoubtedly, when those individuals go up for their license. And so, I think if you are continuing to advertise and continuing to push forward your desire to have this as a line of business, a line of service, as a way to help bring more BCBAs in the field, then I think, you probably need to think about some disclaimers or some comments to be able to help educate those that are coming to you. They are new in the field. They are looking to enter the field. They are naive in many ways, and they will be trusting of someone who has credentials and services such as yours. And because of that, they will not think twice to possibly even read the rules and statutes, as we often find, for the state that they are interested in becoming licensed for. And so that really puts, I don't even see it as really, I mean, the BACB says it's a shared responsibility between the supervisee and the supervisor. But my stance is that if there's a lot more pressure on you as the supervisor to understand that, you are the individual bringing that service forward. You are the individual providing the supervision. You are seen as that individual's mentor. And I'm not absolving the supervisee of their requirements, but you are currently the professional and the license holder or the individual that is nationally certified. And so I think it's worth the time and effort for you to get that organized and clean on a go forward basis. Does that sound like a good plan for you there, Ms. Jones?
Absolutely. We have added it a first and foremost part of our task analysis when bringing on supervisees to review state requirements.
Very good. And I think you're definitely calling out that section about who's allowed to provide supervision for an individual operating in a particular state or wishing to be licensed in that particular state. Just, I think from my own knowledge currently through your consulting group, how many different states are you operating in? And are these operations currently the ones that you have done, you said, due diligence with to ensure that we're not going to have future situations like this with other state boards?
I have only had one supervisee in Arizona, and the rest are out of California. Humehouse employs us as self-contractors, so I can't attest to other contracted BCBAs on where they've provided services.
You mean contracted BCBAs under your group?
Not my group. I work for a company that contracts me as a licensed BCBA.
In California, we've got no licensure status there. And remind me the name of that company again.
It's Humehouse.
Humehouse, that's right. I think we looked at that before. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments or questions?
If I may, Ms. Primary.
Yeah, Dr. Davis Wilson, we can hear you now.
Okay, sorry, it was a little choppy for me for a second. For Dr. Davis, yeah, we did also speak with the owner of Humehouse as well. So hopefully they have taken some of those practices in place. Ms. Jones, I think one of the things that stands out for me in the ethics code is the definition of clients. And so when, so I know that when we talk about supervision and supervising applicants, that tends to sometimes be segregated from the actual practice going to the clients. And so I just, again, just out of a point of education, you know, the client is anybody benefiting from the service. And even if I, as a supervisor, am only providing remote supervision as my line of business, the individuals I'm supervising are still providing a service to a client, because that's how they would be accruing their hours, right? And so so at the end of the day, that client is also affected. And so where that client resides is important. So where I am as a supervisor is also important, because there are telehealth rules about crossing states. That is a whole different topic that you probably also may want to look into, but when it comes to the definition of client, even all the way down to the student or the individual that they're providing the services to, that you're observing, you're providing feedback on, all of those things, those individuals reside in a state where like in Arizona, if they reside in Arizona, they have a law that affords them the right to a licensed behavior analyst. And so even though it may appear, well, I'm only providing supervision, I think the nature of how supervision is providing behavior analytic work to another recipient is where I get that kind of that talk around the practice. And I bring that back up because I know early on, and I know you have done some reflection since then, but you had written to the board and said, I've never practiced in Arizona, which I think is very common from what I hear from others of, oh, I'm only supervising, I'm not practicing. And so I just like to kind of bring up the point of that there's a recipient receiving ABA services, and that recipient resides in a state in which those services require the individual to be licensed. So somebody is practicing. And I would argue that by extension, you are practicing because you're supervising the licensee. But I also think it's important to note, not only does it affect the licensee's ability to get licensed themselves, but now they are also practicing without a license, or potentially practicing without a license. And so, I hate to harp and keep going on about that, but I do think that we have to have some conversations as a field around how different really is supervision versus actually practicing, and is there a difference, and what does that look like to the end user, like the client? And so just something to keep in mind. And again, I bring up Texas because they actually have in there that that students accruing hours are exempt from licensure. And the way they have it written is that the supervisors are also, which is interesting to me, but they're one of the only states that has that. But to Dr. Davies' point, California doesn't have a law, so you have less to worry about there. But just something to think about, that it's not just the effects of supervision that are at play here, but also the students and the clients are also equally affected, because they're the ones that are residing in a state in which the practice of behavior analysis requires licensure. And licensure is a public protection initiative. And so we have licensure, you know, in Arizona and Tennessee to protect those consumers. And so when we start to draw kind of a distinction between, well, this is supervision and not practice, then it's those consumers that are at risk. And so I just wanted to kind of circle back to that and that particular section of the ethics code. That is all I had, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Any other comments or questions? Okay, so the committee will now begin their deliberation. Please note that deliberation is time for committee members to deliberate the case among themselves without interruptions from complainants, respondents. Dr. Davis Wilson, since you're the lead on this case, would you please begin with the deliberations?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I have reviewed all the documents, I've reviewed the concerns. I do think the applicant has come complainant has come forth before us today and has been very professional, has answered our questions and concerns, appears to be receptive to the feedback we're providing. She has acknowledged that MW was the only supervisee she had in Arizona. MW is now a licensed behavior analyst because we were able to she was able to find alternative hours to cover her time. And so for me, unless committee members have other discussion, I think that I'm satisfied with the complainant's approach to this response, and after hearing from my peers, would be leaning in the direction of a dismissal.
Other discussion.
I just will say I agree. I mean, I think part of this is an education piece. There was no, I believe that Mrs. Jones has come forward and has made the statement that she understands that she was in error, that she's got some work to do to fully understand those areas. She's working in those areas, has offered to take extended ethics credits, has been honest and forward with the committee. And so I feel the same way Dr. Davis Wilson does.
I do likewise. I appreciate the efforts that Ms. Jones has made in rectifying the situation, and the further efforts that she's indicated with her continuing educational credits as well. So, any other comments? Okay, is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we dismiss this complaint.
This would be a recommendation, correct, to the board for dismissal?
Yes, thank you. I move that we recommend to the full board that we dismiss this complaint.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Wilson. Is there a second?
Well, second.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Ms. Jones, again, thank you for attending this and the importance of doing this, and appreciate the efforts, as I said earlier, for the attempts that you've made to try to fix the situation and moving forward. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate everyone's perspective and understanding as well. This is a huge learning opportunity for myself.
Thank you. Okay, moving on to agenda item number 6, consideration for approving behavior analyst
application. I'm so sorry to interject. I was fumbling to turn off the mute button. I just wanted, before Ms. Jones departed, to let her know that because of the recommendation for a dismissal, we can put this on the April 8th board meeting agenda for the board to review. So that's just a week from today. And Ms. Jones, I'll follow up with you by email just to notify you how you might attend that board meeting if you choose to do so. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, so due to the status of Dr. Davis Wilson's location, I'm going to go through and have her review her applicants first, and then we'll move on back to the other applicants. So Dr. Davis Wilson, are you fine with that?
Yep, that sounds great.
Okay. All right. So let's, our first application we'll review is Lindsay Gill. So.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gill passed her exam in February of 2022. She completed the ASU Master's in Curriculum and Instruction online. She did do 1,500 hours from multiple supervisors. In reviewing the multiple supervisor form and the form that was signed, it appears that there's different hours that are listed. The form that is signed covers the hours, the number of hours, but I just thought it was interesting that the multiple supervisor form reflected about half, well, a little over half, about 70% of those hours. I think the multiple supervisor form is a tool that we use internally to help navigate all the different documents that are required. So I'm not sure that it would hold up the application.
However, one thing that I did note is that it appears that supervision occurred across 6 days from January 18th, 2021 to January 24th, 2021. I'm assuming that this is a typo. However, I do think that we need the supervisor and the supervisee to correct those dates before we can move forward, provided they can correct those dates with the years and the time frames that match the supervisor form. Then I think this application is good to go forward, but I think that is a critical edit that needs to be made.
All right. And then one more to be corrected on page 12 of the PDF on response and number 12, the supervised work experience form, the response was omitted. So if we could get that corrected as well.
Perfect.
Okay.
And then provided that both of those are just typos, then I would recommend that this be forwarded to the full board, provided they can get those typos fixed by next week. If they are not typos, then we would need to see this application again.
All right. Thank you. All right. And then let's move on to Anna Crooker, Dr. Davis Wilson again. And I believe Ms. Crooker is on the call as well.
Excellent. Ms. Crooker passed her exam in February of 2022. She completed a master's degree through Ball State University in their Applied Behavior Analysis program. She did complete just 1,500 hours across multiple licensed behavior analysts. I reviewed the application in full, and I do not see any concerns with the application. Would recommend that it be forwarded to the full board for approval.
All right, thank you. And then the last is Sarah Boyd. Again, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Absolutely. Ms. Boyd passed her exam also in February of 2022. She also completed the ASU online curriculum and instruction course and completed 1,500 hours from a licensed behavior analyst. I have reviewed the application, and I also do not have any concerns with this application.
All right. Great. Thank you. Okay. So we'll go back to the top of the list. Jenny Lee Newman, Dr. Davey, you are the lead on that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So Jenny Lee Newman has been forward for licensure in the state of Arizona. She is a licensed BCBA. She indicated on her application that she has also held other licenses, that is actually a Colorado teaching license, which you will see in the documentation is in good standing. She came from their studies at the University of Northern Colorado School of Special Education. She provided us with information with regard to her supervised experience towards her licensure status, or towards her BCBA status. She also provided us a written explanation about her supervision, her requirement to work particular hours, as well as kind of a description around the field work of both restricted and unrestricted times. I found that helpful in reviewing this application and appreciated the applicant including that. Applicant also completed the multiple supervisor one organization form for us that coincides with the documentation provided by the applicant that was turned into the BACB. All individuals that supervised this individual were had completed the 8-hour supervision training. Colorado is not one of the states that is the state where what am I trying to say? None of this happened in Arizona, so the Colorado issue is mute. I would move that this go forward to the full board for approval.
Thank you, Dr. Davey. Next application is Catherine Moody. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on that.
Yes, thank you. So Catherine received her BCBA in 2019. She also indicated that she is also an LBA in the state of Michigan. She completed a master's in science degree in ABA at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology in 2019. All supervision happened at Young Mind Center and Gentry Pediatrics between January of 18 and March of 2019 for a total of 1,502 hours. supervisors met the qualifications required, and I did not see any issues with this application. I would recommend that it move forward.
Thank you, Dr. Reitz. Okay, next application is Sydney Bardelli. I'm the lead on that. Ms. Bardelli was certified as a BCBA in July of 2021. She's has been licensed in Michigan as a behavior analyst since October of 2021. She graduated in June of 2021 from Western Michigan University with a Master's of Arts in Behavior Analysis. She received 1,597.21 hours of supervision under multiple Michigan licensed behavior analysts. I did not know any concerns and recommend that it move forward to the board for approval. Okay, next application is Maisie Rogers. Dr. Davey, you're the lead on that, and Ms. Rogers is on the call as well.
Thank you. Yes, Ms. Rogers comes forward for licensure in the state of Arizona, having been a board-certified behavior analyst since February of 2022. She completed her application in its entirety, listing Arizona State University's special education applied behavior analysis program as where she received her training. She also indicated that she received supervised experience towards her certification and licensure at several locations here in the state of Arizona. As such, we do have, I believe, about 9 different supervisors that are listed on the multiple supervisors, probably not from one or from one organization. The first one that's shared there has what was identified as a typo in the list, Ms. Brianna Newman, now King, which is the third one. Her actual ability to start supervising BCBAs is not 9/29/20 as listed on this document. It is actually verified in the documentation below to be 2018, so well within her scope to be able to provide that supervision. Applicant provided us with final experience verification forms for her work or for her supervision with those multiple individuals. And we have, having looked through the documentation, she also provided the more multiple supervisors coming in from several other agencies that were listed on her application. And doing the math and cross-referencing the dates and looking at the list of, I think in total, it ended up being close to 16 different supervisors. All paperwork appears to be in order, and I would move that this go forward to the board for approval.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Davey. All right, next application is Gabrielle Thomas. Dr. Reitz, you're the lead on that.
Yes. So the individual received their BCBA in November of 21 and also indicated that they are an LBA in the state of Texas. They completed a master's degree in ABA at the University of Dayton in August of 21. Supervision all occurred in the state of Texas for a total of 1,574 hours, and that occurred between January of 2020 to September of 21. The only thing that I noted on this application is that on the supervision form that was submitted, there were several no's that were checked. We did receive an explanation for each of those. I think the first two are sufficient and just indicating that the individual didn't do these things independently, but did them with the supervisor. The third one, however, indicates that there was a multiple supervisor model that was utilized. And so I am just reaching out to my colleagues here to, I don't think we've seen this before on this form, and I'm wondering if we need to have more information on who those other supervisors were that would have participated in that supervision. Other than that, I didn't have any issues of concern, but that was one that I did note for the committee to discuss.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I do agree with Dr. Reitz that those components are required of supervision, and so we would need the documentation to show that they were completed.
All Other comments on that?
I think one of the issues there is, you know, the individual that's signing off, right, by attesting, you know, you're essentially saying it's true to their knowledge, right, in terms of the supervision form and where they've checked no under Ms. Waits, you're referring to 3,
yes,
C and B, correct?
Yes, that's correct. And then 4.
I mean, part of it is you know, kind of goes back to our discussion previously as a board of the individual signing off on this. Are they knowledgeable of the entire, you know, scope of work, or whether they were individually involved in all of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of see it two ways, like whether or not Jamie Marion, the supervisor, was aware of what those things going on with multiple supervisors. She could attest to that, I guess, as one way, or we would need the other supervisors that did see those things checking off. It does seem odd for a strong no to both C and D, given that this individual is attesting for almost 1500 hours. So that was the part that just gave me pause. It wasn't so much that there was an explanation of multiple supervisors. It was the idea that this individual in filling this out did not feel like they could give a yes after a year of supervision. So I'm unsure how to take that.
It gives me pause. Go ahead, Dr. Reitz.
Yeah, I think that I really interpreted that differently in terms of number 3, C and D. How I interpreted that was not that they didn't feel the individual had competency in that, but that they didn't allow that to happen, have them running that, and that's their policy at the organization. So they were involved, but again, that's just my interpretation, Dr. Davey.
Yeah. Well, maybe we need a little bit cleaner explanation so we're not having to guess. I mean, I could see it go both ways.
Yeah.
I think your way makes sense as well. But again, I would just think that overseeing an implementation of a program by others, so that would mean simply shadowing, right? I mean, you're shadowing the BCBA. So even if you're receiving supervision, treatment by protocol modification, you would be overseeing a behavior analyst in action while they're implementing a program. So that to me just doesn't, it just didn't quite square with me with the numbers. I'm saying that's not the only way you can oversee other things, but that one comes to mind just because it's linked to billing practices. Mm-hmm. Managing performance, I could see that maybe, you know, that might be a little bit, you know, out there in terms of initial BCBA training. Obviously, we want to see them providing trainings to others, particularly as they're getting closer and closer to the crowning moment of sitting for a BACB exam. We all know that in terms of educational schema, that if you can teach something, you know it very well, is the assumption if you can teach others. So again, I think some clarification around that, it would be helpful. I don't know how others feel.
I think that's appropriate. I think we'd want to get a little bit more around the other piece anyway, just in terms of the supervisors. So perhaps it's just a request for additional information regarding those 3 no answers.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Reitz. Okay, next application is Alexa Avalos. Disclaimer, I was her instructor while she was working on her Master's of Science. And Ms. Denton, you are the lead on that.
Ms. Denton, before you begin, Mr. Chair, can we just clarify with board staff that they have enough,
sure,
based on Dr. Reitz and I's conversation to formulate an RFI? Okay, I'm seeing.
Yes, I do, Dr. Davey.
Okay, oh, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Ms.
Malice. Thanks, sir.
Thank you. I guess that wasn't Ms. Malice. That was Jennifer. Or no, yeah.
It was Ms. Malice.
Yeah.
I got Ms. Malice over here, and I got Colin user number 1, who are both Ms. Malice. So I'm like, wait, that didn't work.
And then,
Sorry.
Dr. Davis-Wilson, did you have any comments to make as we start this next application?
I did. I too was an instructor for this applicant. However, I do not see any reason as to why I cannot proceed with review of her application.
Great. Thank you. All right. Ms. Denton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alexa Avalos comes forth seeking licensure in the state of Arizona after passing her board-certified behavior analyst exam in February of 2022. She graduated with a Master's of Science in ABA from Arizona State University in May of 2021. Her supervision occurred from September 25th of 2019 to November 16th of 2021, all within the state of Arizona. This application is somewhat similar to the last application. However, I think there are a couple of pieces that are a bit different here. This applicant received all of her supervision, a total of 1,897 hours under one agency, four different licensed behavior analysts, all in good standing, who have met all of the requirements to provide supervision by the appropriate dates, provided this supervision. The regional director, who is on this call, Raquel Elvey, oversaw all of the supervisors who provided the supervision and ultimately signed off on the supervision form to the board, attesting to all of the requirements being met. So at this point, based off of the comment that is made, and I'll read it on here from Alexa. It does say the total is over 1,500 hours because I still needed unrestricted hours and continued to work to count her restricted as well. Raquel Elvey, the regional director, oversaw my supervision experience with each supervisor and completed an audit on my supervision log and hours and ultimately signed my final verification form. Since I had four different clinicians oversee my experience for roughly the same amount of hours each time. So at this point, given the thoroughness and the clarity that was provided and the oversight provided to each supervisor, I don't see any particular issue with this. The applicant is on the line as well as the supervisor who signed off. So if there are any questions to be asked by fellow committee members, then it's available.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn. Okay.
If there are no questions, then I move that this goes to the full board for
a great.
I would just say that I would give kudos to the applicant as well as the supervisors in working through this. There was a lot, and having done that due diligence, I think helped us not have a lot of questions. So thank you.
Okay, next applicant, our application is Tracy Mock. I'm the reviewer for that. Ms. Mock was certified as a BCBA in August of 2019. She graduated in June of 2021 from Ball State University with a Master's of Arts in Applied Behavior Analysis with an emphasis in autism. She received 1,216 hours of supervision under Texas LBA Laura Saldana, who was licensed in June of 2018 and supervised from August of 2017 to July of 2018. Ms. Mock received 376.25 hours of supervision from two BCBAs in Georgia, which does not require licensure, for a total of 1,529.25 hours of supervision. One thing I did note is that the Texas licensure began in 2017. Ms. Mock's Texas supervisor was not licensed until June of 2018. This would constitute about 10 months of supervision from an unlicensed professional in Texas. If any of my fellow committee members have any comments about that or note that there may have been a grace period or grandfather clause in the Texas licensure, please let me know. But at this point, as I stated, there's about 10 months of supervision from a non-licensed professional in Texas.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to ask Ms. Folks and Ms. Mellis to see if they can find the document that we had prepared. I'll search for it as well, but I think we may have that data somewhere.
Okay. Just looking at the BACB's website with their licensure, it says 2017. I didn't look any farther than 2017, but that was an issue. So I guess if we could get a solid date on that, we could. At this point, unless I'm misinterpreting what the dates are, then we would need a request for additional information documenting the number of hours received under the Texas supervisor outside of the licensure period, which again began in June of 2018 for Ms. Aldana, the Texas supervisor. Can Ms. Pakenham, would it be okay if we moved on to the next applicant and we can come back and address this? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So next application is Alexis Prinslow. Ms. Dent, you're the reviewer for that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Prinslow passed her board certified behavior analyst exam on November 22nd of 2021 after graduating with a master's in science and psychology from Capella University with a specialization in applied behavior analysis in June of 2021. Ms. Prinslow received her supervision from January 8th of 2020 to October 1st of 2021, all in the state of Oregon under one licensed behavior analyst in the state of Oregon for a total of 2,069.61 hours. It should also be noted that this applicant is licensed in the state of Oregon as a behavior analysis interventionist, which from my research and new learning opportunities appears to be that RBT level requires licensure in Oregon, and this applicant has been in good standing with that license in Oregon. Given everything that I have reviewed, there are no concerns from me, and I would move that it goes forward to the full board.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, hey. I did find the Texas information if you're ready to receive that. Our research found that September 1 of 2018 was the date and time at which licensure was required in Texas.
Okay.
So 9/1/2018.
Okay. So given that, Ms. Mock has enough hours, and with that cleared up, then I recommend that this move forward to the board for approval. All right. Thank you for looking on that. Appreciate it. Okay, next application is Allison LaRocca. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on that?
Yes. The applicant received their BCBA certification in 2019. They also indicated that they are a licensed LBA in both the state of Kansas and Missouri. The individual completed their master's degree in education in 2017 from ASU. Supervision occurred in the state of Kansas for a total of 1,500 hours by a licensed BCBA at that time. So in reviewing the application, I didn't see any concerns and would recommend that it move forward.
All right, thank you. Next application is Hannah Azzano. Ms. Dent, you're the lead on that.
Thank you. Ms. Azzano passed her board certified behavior analyst exam in August of 2019, August 31st to be specific, after graduating with a master's in education in applied behavior analysis from the online ASU program in May of 2019. She received her supervision from January 8th of 2018 until May of 2018, and then resumed that supervision from July of 2018 until February of 2019. The gap in supervision appears to be due to a relocation. She received 911 hours of supervision in the state of Texas under a licensed Texas Behavior Analyst. She is also now a licensed Texas Behavior Analyst since September 24th of 2021. Upon moving to Arizona, she received 564 hours of supervision under an Arizona licensed behavior analyst, a grand total of 2,778 hours of supervision by licensed behavior analysts. The license in Texas is also under good standing in Texas. I believe this candidate is very qualified to move forward to the full board for approval.
Thank you. All right, next application is Alexis Pascarella. Dr. Davey, you are the lead on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Pascarella comes forward seeking licensure in the state of Arizona. She has been a board certified behavior analyst since December of 2020. She completed her application, noting that Ball State University is where she received her graduate education in applied behavior analysis. She has completed the application in its entirety, listing two different supervised experience activities towards her licensure and certification, both occurring in Chicago. We have copies of, we have copies of multiple supervisors at one location. Everything there looks to be aligned with the documentation that was provided to the BACB. We have no licensure issues in Illinois, and everyone was cleared to provide supervision by the BACB. Same for the second organization. Then we, I think that is the conclusion of this one, and I would move that it go forward to the full board for approval.
Thank you, Doug. All right, next application is Connie Jo Grilly. I'm the lead on that one. Ms. Grilly was certified as a BCBA in December of 2021. She is certified educator in Arizona, Oklahoma, and was a licensed teacher in Kansas. Ms. Grilly graduated in 12 of 1994 with an MED in special education from Washburn University and earned her ABA certificate in August of 2021 from ASU's online program. She received 1,500 hours of supervision under two Arizona licensed behavior analysts. I did not know any concerns and recommend this move forward to the board for approval. All right. Last application is Sarah Boyd. We are done. Do I have a motion to move some of these to the board for approval?
I'll move, with the exception of the one we're seeking additional information from Dr. Rates, applicant. I think that was that LaRocca?
Number six, actually.
Number six. Gabrielle Thomas. Then I'll move that one through five and seven through 15 be moved to the full board for approval.
Right. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
And Mr. Chair, just to clarify, Ms. Gill would need to make those edits and confirm that they are typos before we can move hers.
Thank you. All right. Do I have a second?
I'll second.
Okay, thank you. Further discussion? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. Opposed? Okay, motion carried. All right, let's move on to agenda item number seven, discussion on the Telehealth Advisory Committee. Dr. Davey.
Just a brief update. We continue to move forward on the audio-only codes. If you remember, I talked a little bit about that last time. So these would be services that were completely provided by simply a telephone, no video. Allow that because there's a different whole code set for that, and I wanted to bring to the board's attention that there's documents out there from both APBA as well as CASP talking about which services are appropriate for telephonic, and in many cases they blend the idea that something could be done telephonic as part of also being live or also being on video and making a call. Like it's not a it's not a solely just a phone call to be able to conduct, you know, to bill 15 minutes for Codex. It is more of a combination of what a vignette may include. In looking at the codes, and this is where I kind of want to just have a brief discussion, the reality of what you can do on the phone with someone is likely tied to the assessment pieces, right? So those of us that are still engaged in practice, you could conduct a behavior identification assessment that included administering some sort of standard or non-standardized scale. You could get medical history, all of these things that are kind of part of the onboarding, right? So kind of that 97151. You could probably also have a technician do some of that as well, maybe conduct a brief preference assessment or a brief, get a list of reinforcers for a potential face-to-face meeting that's coming up at some particular point. So that could fall under 97152 in my estimation. And in some respects, the first part of even the assessment code that's tied to very complex behaviors, the first part of that, the 0362T code, some of those things could be done on the phone as well, independently. When we get down to I don't believe that many of you would have any issues with what I just said, but if you do, please speak up and then we'll move kind of to the treatment side of the world. Okay. So on the
For clarification, is there boundaries to which telephonic can be used? If you said that, I'm sorry I missed it, but have they indicated what it's only allowed for, or the exclusion to which it can be used?
Well, this is suggesting this would be allowed for particular billing codes, which are already racially defined by AMA and CPT.
Okay.
So 97151, for example, behavior identification assessment administered by a physician or other qualified QHP, each 15 minutes of the physician's or QHP's time, face-to-face, which we'll talk about in a second, with patient and or guardian administering assessments and discussing findings and recommendations, and non-face-to-face analyzing past data, score interpretation of the assessment, and preparing the report and treatment plan. So part of that, right? There's sections of that where administering the assessment or discussing the findings and recommendations or all of those could be done telephonically.
Got it. Okay. All right. Thank you.
So that would just kind of follow them with 152 as well as 0362. So when we get to treatment, the committee has a mix of both physical and behavioral health professionals. It's an integrated committee. Telephonically, we've all kind of come to the conclusion with access driving the discussion that, you know, there's a lot of treatment that probably can occur on phone, but there's also many treatments, particularly that are psychiatric, psychological, and behavior analytic that require you to have eyes on. So when it comes to telephonic, and you kind of go through our category one treatment codes, you know, there's really just a couple of guidance codes that come to mind where you might be, it's appropriate to do something on the phone. So trying to do treatment by protocol on the phone only with a parent is going to be a hard sell to access and AMA and CPT. Same with a group on a phone. Adaptive behavior treatment with protocol modification, which is supposed to be the BCBA working directly with someone while the technician is watching that. Difficult to do that phone only, right? Family adaptive behavior treatment guidance, however, 97156. Guidance on a plan, parent calls and says, hey, you know, Billy's not responding to my if-then statements. Billy's not responding to different things, or Billy's got a behavior intervention plan from the community and mom's stuck at Target. Being able to provide guidance over the phone, myself and the committee believe that was something that was very viable in 97156. Probably not so much treatment guidance to a bunch of families at once on the phone. That would be similar to, probably very difficult to do with multiple families in kind of the committee's opinion. They were more of the mindset of individual, make more sense. group adaptive behavior treatment, same as regular adaptive behavior treatment, a no-go in the committee's eyes. So really, assessment codes and 97157 appear to be the ones that telephonic only would be appropriate. And if we have a follow-up call in about 4 weeks, where this letter will be finalized by Access, and it'll actually go to AMDN's EPP requesting that they either one, drop the terminology face-to-face in those codes, or override it and allow for a telephonic-only modifier in those areas. And again, these are the ones that affect us as professionals. I've also been working with Heidi and Dr. Meyer on some that may affect psychologists, and we'll be speaking to them soon about those. But for this committee, I wanted to bring those to your attention. When we get to the video part of it, when we get to interactive and face-to-face is considered what we're doing right now, the code set really opens up wide at that particular point. But the telephonic is, one, we're restricted by our own language and face-to-face, and two, we're somewhat restricted in our practice. Like a lot of what we do, you can't phone it in if you will. So I just wanted to have that discussion with you all, get any other additional insights you might have.
Any discussion on that?
Dr. Davey, I think Mr. Chair, I apologize, Dr. Davey. I think that those are all great points about the telephonic. You know, I do wonder if portions of, and this has probably been considered already, if portions of the assessment, of course, you know, could potentially be gathered, specifically thinking of indirects and whatnot, if we were to do a QABF or whatnot on the phone. But when it comes to even the family guidance, were there any thoughts or discussion around the misuse of the telephonic? Because one of the things that I see often, if I'm consulting with organizations and I'm doing a documentation audit for medical necessity review, a lot of chatting with families is being called family guidance. And I just wonder if that might exacerbate the issue. I know it's this fine line of we've got to be progressive in how we move these codes towards what should be professionally expected. But the reality of it is like right now, the billing of, at least from what I'm seeing when I'm looking at it, the billing of that code already seems to be pretty lax. Were there any discussions about what that might do if there were some latitude around telephone calls? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, the discussion has not been specific to our code sets. We do have several individuals that represent, we'll just say, quality and cost containment from Access that listen into these discussions, as our activities could be viewed as not budget neutral in some ways. They could be budget stable given that we're just exiting out of the emergency. But we have not had specific to our particular ones. I think that the expectation is that individuals that are engaging in any billing are following the clinical examples as they're outlined by AMA and CPT in multiple vignettes, and you know, variations outside of those vignettes that, you know, I don't have it in front of me, but I remember writing the vignette for this one. It really talks about when you've got the treatment protocol in place and you are essentially helping a parent, I can't forget the exact words we use, but it was like changing reinforcement to promote an individual's use of like gestures or indicating stop or an activity they wanted help with. Like you could give that kind of particular treatment protocol tied guidance, and that is an appropriate activity for that particular code. What people are using that code for, you know, they run their own risks of fraud, waste, and abuse by Access and reviews and audits by payers. I think all of those discussions are there for everything we're opening up in terms of telehealth. I think that those were some pausing points early on. I think to date, Access has not had enough complaints. MCOs are not coming back with additional concerns with what happened during the pandemic with regard to use of telephonic as well as telehealth codes. And so I'm sure they'll keep their eye on it, but to date, no real conversation.
Any other discussion on that?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Davey. Let's move on to number 8, update related to the BACB and the Association for Professional Behavior Analysts. Ms. Pacman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Just a really brief update was supplied by the BACB since your last meeting, and it's material that you are all quite familiar with, just assisting regulators in accessing all the versions of the ethical code, which of course we supply to you as part of your meeting resources. Should you ever need to refer to other versions of the code other than the current one, that is. And speaking of resources, we were just a few moments ago talking about the chart that we've prepared, the research that we've prepared relative to when states have enacted licensure and at which point in time licensure is required. We're putting that material in your resources folder, so you can refer to that if you ever have a question about an application. So that is all I have with respect to BACB updates.
Thank you. And then continuing. Oh, yeah, Dr.
On the resource folder, when will that be updated? Because I typically grab that and leave that on my desktop. So will that be updated next week sometime with that information, Ms. Pacman?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davey, I think that's reasonable. So we have a couple of states, new states to add to the list. Our former student intern, Caitlin Doherty, conducted this research about a year ago. So we need to make sure the new states have been added. And if the new license required dates are known, we'll put those in as well. So yes, give us about a week.
That's fine. Maybe just an update to the committee that it has been updated and we can go grab it, because it is extremely helpful, those documents that over the course of years you've put in there for us.
Yes, Ms. Malice can do that for you once we're confident that information is all complete.
Thank you, Ms. Miles.
Okay. And continuing, discussion regarding the draft proposed revisions of the administrative rules that regulate practice behavior analysis. Ms. Pacman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Also a quick update. So you last heard that we had received approval from the governor's office to file the notice of proposed rulemaking. And we had talked about the fact that as required component of that process is to conduct a public hearing where the public can attend and submit oral comments to the proposed changes. Throughout the public comment period, written comments can be submitted to the board office, but we are required to have one event where the public can come and address us virtually. In this case, it would be. So we had hoped that we could schedule that to sort of piggyback onto a CBA meeting. Unfortunately, due to the timeframes that are prescribed in administrative rule for when that hearing needs to take place, we could only schedule it on May 20th. So I can send an invitation, which would be a voluntary, May 20th at 9 a.m. It can be voluntary attendance on the part of the CBA members. But that being said, I think it would be ideal if we could have even just one CBA member attend, just for purposes of hearing what members of the public are commenting and processing that information from a professional perspective. So we are not to, during this hearing, we're not to answer questions or engage in debate or conversation about the proposed changes. We are merely there to collect the public comment. But I think it would be beneficial if a licensed behavior analyst and particularly or a member of the CBA could be there just to sort of think about it from a licensed behavior analyst perspective. So That is the status of the rule promulgation. After that public comment is all collected, it goes to the board for review, and the board may or may not make modifications to the proposed rules based on that comment. But we do have to supply responses to the comments that we've received. Those responses go to the Governor's Regulatory Review Council.
All right, great. Thank you. And next is
Mr. Chair.
Oh yeah, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Sorry, I just wanted to point out, and perhaps there's data that suggests otherwise, but Ms. Pakanon, I think this will make hearing number four. And we've received written public comments, but I don't think in any of the other hearings we've actually had anybody come for the opportunity to provide verbal comments. So, I know we're happy. I'm happy to. Other behavior analysts may be happy to attend to just listen. But just as maybe something to, I don't know if we have any of that historical data. But I don't think that members of the public have come forward verbally. I think it's all been in writing. Just
Mr. Chair, Dr. Davis Wilson, I would agree that what you're describing is very commonplace. I can recall from, well, just one instance since I've been with this board, we've held a public hearing for purposes of collecting comments to rules. And Ms. Poe and I sat in an empty room together for an hour and no one came to visit us, but we did our due diligence with respect to, you know, fulfilling this requirement. When I worked for the Board of Physical Therapy, again, very common for no one or virtually no one to show up. On occasion, we would see someone from the professional association, you know, stop by and probably offer the same comment that they had already submitted to us in writing, but just, you know, to make, for purposes of making an appearance, that was generally the only participation that we had in that fashion. So I would agree. It won't be standing room only when we hold this event, but we will fulfill the requirement and then, you know, move the rule package forward afterwards.
Hey, any other comments on this item? All right, let's move on to 10, discussion of proposed legislation. Ms. Pakanon.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I only have updates to supply to three of the bills. Most of the bills on this list, as I'm sure you've observed, have zero chance of passing at this point, unless they are somehow resurrected as a Stryker amendment bill, and that's becoming increasingly unlikely with where we are at the present time in the session. And I anticipate that we're going to see the few bills that are progressing still. Those are going to, in many cases, slow down or be paused because the governor is indicating to the legislature that he wants to see the proposed budget bills developed before he makes any more decisions about signing legislation. So I think we're going to see the attention shift to the budget. And because there's such an extreme budget surplus in our state, I think that's going to take a lot of time to craft a budget that addresses a lot of both the existing funding needs and new priorities that many legislators want to bring forward. So the three bills that I want to talk about include the House Bill 2612, Occupational Regulation. That is the bill that strips the term good moral character out of many sets of statutes, including the behavior analysts. The governor signed that bill on March 24. So 90 days after the session concludes, that language will disappear from your statutes. And as we've heard from Ms. Galvin, we will receive some legal advice at a future date on that topic. Another bill, which sort of, it is a Stryker bill, so it emerged very, very recently, very suddenly and very recently, Senate Bill 1309, temporary licenses, health professionals extension. The governor requested this bill to extend the temporary emergency licenses that health boards have granted in response to the state of emergency. This bill extends those licenses to a new expiration date out into the future, which is December 31st of 2022. And the governor had indicated that passing that bill, enacting that change, was a required predecessor to his declaration that the state of emergency was now ready to be lifted, which he lifted that on, I believe it was March 28th, so a few days ago. So we have 42 behavior analysts with those temporary emergency license privileges. And they will today receive an email from me indicating that previously you were advised your emergency temporary license would expire the date of the lifting of the emergency. However, it's been extended to December 31st, 2022. Any questions about that bill? The governor signed that one on the 25th.
Ms. Pakkinen, could you just repeat which bill number that was?
Yeah, Senate Bill 1309. And then the last bill, Senate Bill 1568, this is a bill that has been touted as board reform. It has really been championed by a couple of attorneys who frequently represent pharmacists and nurses who are respondents to complaints. There are many provisions of this bill. It's been amended. It may be amended again. The one provision of the bill that is of some concern to this board, at least the staff, is the requirement that investigations be completed within 180 days. And so that provision is still alive in the bill. It's somewhat controversial. And I have heard that some legislators are not going to continue supporting this bill unless that provision is somehow modified in order to not tie the hands of board and board staff to be so restrictive. It has stalled, I've noticed, in the House. It's barely passed the Senate. I don't know what its chances are in the House, but I'm sort of waiting to see if it doesn't get a hearing in the Rules Committee, then effectively that bill will not pass. But that's one that I continue to watch very closely. Any questions about that? Okay.
Okay. All right, next agenda. Discussion regarding the cloud for government behavior analyst application demonstration. Ms. Pakkinen.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I won't be supplying a demonstration to the committee today, unfortunately. We have experienced some halted progress as it relates to getting this application launched. We abruptly lost our primary analyst that was assigned to us. And so the company is assigning a new set of resources to us. And one of those resources fell ill earlier this week. And I had hoped that I would hear from her that some of the changes that we had requested had been pushed into the QA environment for me to demonstrate today, but I don't have any updates. So unfortunately, this is going to have to be delayed to a future date.
All right. Okay. Thank you. And the next item is discussion, request from the Arizona Association of Behavior Analysts to share historical information. Ms. Pakkinen.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just reached out to our AZ ABBA leaders who had indicated that they were very interested in having this discussion with us in terms of the historical information that they have collected and the progression of regulation of behavior analysts in Arizona. And so I think it was Dr. Davey who had suggested that we bring this idea forward. We have some discussion with the stakeholder group and perhaps outline how we might move this project forward. Very recently, I've been thinking about this in terms of a possible project for a student intern, which we haven't been placed with a student intern for now over a year, unfortunately, but hopefully we will be able to partner again with both Arizona State University and now the Honors College at NAU, Northern Arizona University. So I'm hoping that if not this summer, in the fall, we will have student interns. And I just see this as an exciting project that, that person could take on. But I think we want to hear from our guests. I see that Ms. Elzey and Ms. Blokas is still here. Welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. It's still morning, right? Yeah. Good morning, everyone. we're really excited to hear about this. We appreciate the invite. Thank you so much. This was actually in discussions with our Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Committee, specifically as a objective considering the impact of legislation in issues relating to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and knowing how much impact that makes in our community, and what great strides we've made in the state of Arizona with regard to our behavior analytic licensure efforts, and wanting to share those efforts with the younger members of the community who may be newer to policy and legislation and how that came about. Because that educational and historical lens really lends towards what we do in the future. So this was a discussion point and on the dream list for our committee has taken some different directions. We have a few things in the works, but we would love to partner with the board in order to accomplish a more comprehensive look back, and we were hoping that this could be something that would be accessible and a reference point for our members and our community in the future as well. So really excited to hear that you all have the same ideas.
Yes, and I echo Jessica's sentiments. This has absolutely been on our radar for a few years now, and we are definitely interested in collaborating on this. And I guess my biggest question is kind of when you are thinking about this sort of project, kind of what does it look like? I know Diana had put together a video for a presentation, or not a presentation, but a conference that she attended that had some really great information. And are we thinking of a video of a actual like written document? How do you envision this kind of coming to light? And then also, yes, what can we do to sort of push it forward?
Yeah, I think it was myself that brought it up, and then Dr. Davis Wilson that then pointed out you all have been kind of formulating your own thoughts around this. I don't know that I have any particular like grand vision of it. I just, whether it's interviews with the psychologists that helped us make this happen, Dr. Wexler, I'm trying to think of some of the others that were initially a part of it, talking to them about how they helped us navigate this and became really advocates for our ability to become licensed, and talking with Dan Davidson and Mr. Giles about some of the early efforts, and our talking to just some of those key people that early on were a part of this, right? Without the psychologists, even without Ms. Galvin, and I don't mean to make her blush, but helping us navigate how behavior analysts could even be involved early on with the psychology board, because we were not going to be, we had to be agendized every time we wanted to talk. They worked very hard to figure out ways to bring us in and talk about our concerns or our thoughts around how a statute might be crafted. All these things that without some very key players early on, it's unlikely it would have gone as well as it has. So I just want to make sure we capture that while there's been, ups and downs as there are in any relationship, the ability of two professional groups to come together, ultimately see the greater good through those that were, thought leaders in both fields was really just an amazing feat when you look at, the fact that this was early on in 2000, 10-ish, right? I mean, this was well advanced from what we see today. So I don't really have any designs. I just know that there's a lot of people that help make this happen, and getting, you know, their thoughts on the process, or their take on how they help navigate this, relationships that were formed. I think that would be really a great way to capture the history here. I don't know if others have thoughts too.
Yeah, other comments.
Mr. Chair, I think too, one of the things that we talked about last time was extending it to, obviously we want to capture kind of the history of the board, but part of, or the role of the behavior analyst in getting this piece, but part of what got us here too was some of the movement of Stevens Law and the pilot, at the time it was called the HABM program, the Village Asian Masters program that DVD put together. So there were other outside kind of programs that I think by leveraging the association for this purpose, we could kind of mirror the same thing with each one of those initiatives, because they all kind of play a role in one another as far as what then made regulation important, different from our normal like role in education system. And now we're providing, you know, medically necessary healthcare services and kind of how that played into it. So I think that was one of the things that we discussed. And I would agree that kind of a format of interviewing some of those key stakeholders would be nice, both to see it all come together, but also to look at, and Dr. David probably remembers this, the very first time that we attended a APBA licensure meeting was, you know, in 2010, shortly after 2011, shortly after the enactment of our bill. And everybody there was like, whatever you do, do not get on a board with psychologists. And I think that, I think we have a really good story to tell that can help, I think, advance public protection through the collaboration that we've had. And I think as a state in general, in all of the public policy work, no secret that I like public policy when it comes to the work that we do. But we've been very progressive, and I think there are still states and programs that are still trying to dip their toes in this. And I think that we have a good story to tell.
Any other comments? All right. Well, Ms. Balakas and Ms. Elzy, thanks for your comments about this and the partnership, I guess, in moving this information forward to the community as well. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, maybe appointing a committee of subcommittee or something to that effect. I'm thinking about the fact there are five of you, and so a subcommittee is
laughable,
almost comical. But obviously you need some sort of an administrative resource. I have an idea for one. I don't have one yet. So I think that, at least maybe in the beginning, a committee, a joint committee of the association and members of the CBA, maybe outline this project while I work on the, you know, how do we secure someone to coordinate and execute the work and carry out the vision. Maybe that's the right strategy. I don't have a better one right now.
I think too, if we're looking at the interview components and things of that nature, that the association could potentially support with some of the marketing committee's efforts, knowing that their proficiency there with some of those technological details that I don't have. And so if we put together a group between the association and the board, we can loop in those members. I know there's particular members of the AZAPA board who are interested in this effort and have, you know, reached out to Dr. Davis Wilson as well. And so I know that there are some individuals who would be willing on participating.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I would second that. I think if you've followed any of the social media work that the marketing team of AZAPA has done, like, they're one, quite creative, but two, very, again, kind of progressive in their ability to storytell. And I think that if they are willing to and have the leverage of helping conduct some of those interviews, because I think the tricky part is that some of those tasks can't, or we'll run into some issues of some of those tasks being done by board members themselves. But I think that if we had a subcommittee and could leverage some of, again, their talents and what they're already doing in marketing for the association, that would be extremely helpful.
I would be happy to reach out to our marketing chair and team and loop them in on this request.
Other comments?
Mr. Chair, if I may, you know, one of the reasons why this came up, this particular topic came up as a DEI conversation. So I want to kind of tie that in, because I know that wasn't the perspective from the board necessarily, but from some of our committee work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. One of the things that we have noticed in previous in the history, which is it's history, and that's what it is that there has not necessarily been diverse representation. And so one of the things that I think the association may want to also consider in the work that goes into this video is, one, the history, and we create the video, but then to take it to that next step of how do we then ensure, again, in this fashion of being progressive in kind of public policy efforts, speaking association-wise, because like I said, we're limited on the board for our role in those public policy efforts, but how do we educate others on strategies to engage and empower and inform marginalized communities, other individuals that may not be confident that they have a voice, and those sorts of things. And so I just think that that needs to, so I know that Ms. Locus mentioned that it's been a topic of DEI, the history as it was and where we came, you know, lacked a lot of representation from marginalized communities, from other practitioners, different things like that. And so I think acknowledging that and then making sure that the association considers where that then goes for impacting and informing their policy efforts as an association moving forward. Before, it was very much time specific. There was a lot of reasons as to why those weren't at the forefront of the political processes that occurred. Or the public policy processes that occurred. But I think moving forward, the direction the association has been pretty clear on their stance in is how do we make sure that we include those voices from the get-go? And again, I think the stance from the original idea of developing a video, not from the board side, but the association side, was how do we capture the history and learn from it moving forward? And so I just wanted to tie in where that piece would come in. It wouldn't necessarily, I think, be something that we as a board would embark in as the journey, because that kind of gets out of the scope of what we're doing. But I think it's important to acknowledge that the association has an interest in incorporating those efforts into their future public policy efforts.
Yeah. And I would just comment to that, you know, early on, I think it's important to note that the individuals that stepped up to kind of carry the water in Arizona, it was a coalition of the willing. It was not a coalition of selected. And so there was, you know, there was a lot of, I think at any point, any of us would have valued five other people sitting up there talking with the psychologist instead of the same three or four of us that constantly went there. And the same is to be said for this board, that we need other behavior analysts that want to step forward.
You know, Dr. Davey, I agree with you.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I don't disagree that we did not have diversity in 2010 as we were moving this, but I don't think it was from a lack of us not being aware of the need to get multiple voices or, you know, at that particular point in our field, it was just there. Many people did not have the time or were not in positions where they could devote the kind of professional resources that they had to be able to do these things. And Dan Davidson in his position as a professor at that particular point, Dr. Davis and I in more administrative roles, that was allowed. But for many that were working as behavior analysts in the state at that point, they were direct line BCBAs and unlikely that their employers would have allowed them that kind of latitude. So I do think it's important for the future that we inform individuals of how we got here and how they can be a part of the future. And that's by being present at these meetings and learning and getting involved in public policy through the association and through the meetings you all hold. And that will open up avenues for better inclusion and better diversity as we go forward.
I agree.
Another comment. Any other comments? Okay. All right, so let's move on to the next agenda item. Discussion regarding the authority to sign supervision verification documentation. Ms. Pakanon.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So this committee asked for this item to be addressed by the board. And essentially, the board said, we would love to have the committee make some recommendations to us relative to what circumstances or under what parameters or restrictions someone who was not a supervisor but had knowledge of the supervision, when can that person sign off on supervision documentation? And the way that I see this potentially unfolding is that because we have that language in our rule, and I don't have the rule in front of me, I apologize, but someone who has knowledge of the supervision, I think that is lends itself well to the adoption of a substantive policy statement, which is a formally approved document of the board. It's filed with the Secretary of State's office. We publish them on our website. And what that does is it clarifies a board statute or rule. So I just think that this is one of those instances where ideally, through a thoughtful process, we arrive at some recommended language for a substantive policy statement that ultimately we present to the board, and the board approves for purposes of filing and noticing the public.
Mr. Chair, if I may ask for clarification, can we get a reference? And I know you said you don't have it in front of you, but can we look for where it is in the rule? Because when I looked in the rule, I couldn't find it. And so I thought maybe it was just an application-specific thing. But if it's a rule specific thing, that makes my stance on, or my thoughts on this a little bit different.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'm going to search for that language. And quite frankly, Dr. Davis Wilson, I have taken it on good authority, you, that we have that language somewhere. So we do need to find the source of it. So I'll work on that right now.
Yeah, I think when I was looking, and I apologize if I misrepresented it in the full board meeting, but when I was looking, the only place I'm finding it is the application itself. And so my thoughts when we met with the full board was that we would have some leniency to just revise how it revise what's in the application, because I couldn't find it in the rule. Again, it could be in the rule, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And while you're looking for that, I agree with you. The substantive policy would be the solution if it had the rule. But at the, when I made the suggestion at the board meeting, I hadn't found it in the rule. And so I was thinking, like, somehow, I think it was in the rule until we added the fact that we would accept the BACB forms. Mm-hmm. And again, the purpose of having somebody who's knowledgeable sign off on that was to help ease the redundancy between having to have 7 forms signed to submit to the BACB and then having to turn around and have 7 forms signed to submit to the psychology board. And so by us allowing the BACB forms, it kind of does away with that anyway. And I think if we don't have it in rule, which, like I said, I want to be very sure, but if we don't, like, I don't even know why we need to keep it in the application. Again, if it's in the rule, then yes, I would agree that maybe a substantive policy that says here are the circumstances under which, or here's what this, here's an operational definition for what this means.
Mr. Chair, what I'm finding, it isn't exactly what we've been discussing, but R426-403, application for licensure at C1c2, if the board requires additional information, the board shall accept from the applicant or supervisor of the experience letters or other documentation from third parties who observed the supervisory relationship. So not entirely congruent with what we've been talking about, but for what it's worth, that's what I found. So again, letters or other documentation from third parties who observed the supervisory relationship.
Ms. Packon, committee members, that appears to be an as needed sort of thing, not a standard practice, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Oh, I was going to agree with you. I think that would be a very different use of that, where we would be able to say, like, hey, we need this additional information, or we are concerned that you didn't get X experience or hours in this, and what our model looks like. And yes, they did, if they weren't the ones providing the supervision. But I think that the actual workaround of, hey, the supervisors can submit the BACB form, which, by the way, let me add, there are a lot of compliments, and I think we've heard them to the board. We've heard them. I think staff have heard them. I know within my own organization, I'm hearing it for my own staff, but the new license, like the new application process and being able to have the supervisors upload forms, lots of compliments on that. And so I think if people were just uploading the same thing they submitted to the BACB, or if the supervisors were doing that, like, I don't see why, unless a different circumstance where we need more information about the experience itself, why we would keep that language in the application.
Any other comments on that?
This is Jean Galvin. I would ask that Heidi and I have an opportunity to go through the rules together very closely to ensure that some other rule doesn't have the requirement.
Yeah.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, I'm sure Ms. Galvin will agree with me. We have to ensure that we aren't inserting requirements into an application form that do not exist in statute or rule. Once upon a time, in the olden days, as I call it, in the 2000s, I recall that the Governor's Regulatory Review Council was very strict about every question, every field every item on an application had to be present in the rule. It seems that there's been a shift away from that school of thought, which I find to be interesting. We have rule language, and I've seen other boards with rule language that state something to the effect of the applicant shall submit an application that is, you know, available on the board's website, or it just isn't so prescriptive about here is each and every question that you are permitted to ask. And if it's not in that laundry list in the rule, you don't ask it. So I do think what Ms. Galvin is suggesting is really important, because there may be instances where we are deviating or taking some creative liberties on our application and we really shouldn't be.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Peckman, I agree. And that's why I was a little bit taken back when I couldn't find it in the rule. Like I said, I'm not saying it's not in there. I agree that we need a very thorough review, because I thought that for us to be asking it, it would be tied to a rule. But again, I think in history, if we went back to old renditions, I think that was written into the original rules, because we did have concerns about what happened if someone couldn't get a hold of a supervisor. But again, some of that has resolved by allowing the BACB forms. And so I 100% would be in support of doing a really good scrubbing of the rules before we made a decision. Cause like I said, there's two different pathways that we would address this depending on whether that language is there or not.
So Ms. Packon, can we have this on as an agenda item in the future after there's further review of the rules or statutes?
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair, I think we might need a couple of months to do this exercise. So if you don't mind being a little patient, I think we want this to be done very thoroughly. And so we need to take our time in this process.
And thank you for taking that on, and Ms. Galvin as well. All right. Okay, next item. Discussion regarding report on the 2022 annual convention of APBA, Dr. Davis Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So myself and Ms. Michelson and Ms. Packman attended the APBA conference this year in New Orleans. One of the reasons why we requested from the board the ability to attend was because they were having several agenda items on regulation. They also were hosting, the APBA was hosting a licensing and regulators meeting. And they actually also hosted a license and regulators, the BACB actually hosted a license and regulators breakfast. In the psychology, side, and they were
Dr. Davis Wilson, you're breaking up. yeah, exactly, Dr. Davis.
There is a national association, the Association of State and Provincial. Am I coming out? Let me see.
You are.
Is that any better?
That is better, yes. Wait. I spoke too soon. Ms. Packanon, would you be comfortable continuing this conversation, or should we table it until the next meeting?
Mr. Chair, if you want to indulge me, I can provide a little bit of my perspective about this meeting, and maybe by then Dr. Davis Wilson will be in a place where her connection is a little bit more reliable. So while there weren't a lot of sessions for regulators, we still felt that it was worth our time to spend the resources to attend, mostly for the opportunity to engage with the individuals at the BACB who work in tandem with regulators and serve in a quasi-regulatory kind of capacity. I think the more time that we spend together to understand, you know, each other's objectives and how we can work together more effectively, I think that's ideal. We also met members of, you know, who serve on other regulatory boards. There, as far as I can tell, Jennifer and I, Ms. Michelson and I were the only regulatory staff present. And part of my objective for being there too was to plant the seed that perhaps it's now time with 30 some states regulating this profession, that there be content that is specific to, you know, people who work in a regulatory capacity all day, every day. So I hope that was well received. I even offered to be, you know, part of that process to get that idea off of the ground. So I don't expect that to happen, you know, immediately, but I'd like to see an evolution of regulatory content to be even a track, a regulator's track at this meeting.
Well, and I appreciate that you and Ms. Michelson went too. Just the fact that you're one of the, or you were the only regulators present, is I would say a good distinction for the state of Arizona and you know, the advancement of what we've been doing here and the partnership that we have with the BACB and professional organizations and with the regulatory board here locally. So yeah, it's great.
Thank you. I think Mr. Dr. Davis Chair. Wilson may have rejoined. I can't tell.
Mr. Chair, I think that he said I'm most interested.
Ms. Denton, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the piece that I'm most interested in is to hear what Ms. Packanon and what Ms. Michelson found in the presentation. I mean, surely it wasn't just about regulation. I would be interested to know at a later time.
Well, Ms. on that, Ms. Packanon, would you mind giving us a brief summary of what Ms. Denton was requesting, or?
Yes, I think that there's regulation is still pretty much in its infancy. I think that we as a state are out ahead of many other states with respect to, you know, taking on certain regulatory challenges. We have probably a history of cases, investigations that far eclipses what most other states have encountered. I pay attention to things like, you know, what is the administrative structure of the regulatory entity? And I do think that there was a diverse group there. There were, of course, our board, a psychology board, but an advisory committee to the board. There was an independent board presented, represented. I can't remember the other two structures, but what struck me too was that I was a little concerned that the regulatory sessions would just be regulators sitting all together and talking just to each other. But I think I was pleasantly surprised to see that there were just, you know, BCBAs, professionals, LBAs in the sessions who had a genuine interest in regulation and regulation trends. I think it was just really interesting to hear the diverse evolution experiences, particularly of the panel that Dr. Davis Wilson was serving on. So, and I'm going to be careful how I say this, I think, maybe I won't be, but I think that there are some individuals who are, they're representing the regulatory perspective and they really aren't regulators. So I think there's a little bit of danger in that. I appreciate that, you know, they have such an interest in it and they're speaking to, you know, their interest, but I want to see this sort of, I want this content to be for regulators, by regulators, about regulators. And that's why I'm sort of trying to plant the seeds that I am, so that it isn't sort of, I don't want to say hijacked, but it isn't sort of managed by groups or individuals who really aren't doing what we're doing.
Well said.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're exactly right. Everybody serves their own interests, and whether those are your leadership positions within the associations or at agencies across the country, you're exactly right. And, by regulators, for regulators makes a lot more sense. You all have a very unique skill set, a unique scope, very well informed perspective on how this goes. Most other people have opinions on how they want it to go, and that's a much different lens. So
it almost has a Lincoln ring to it, Dr. Davey. Nice.
Thanks.
So, all right, Dr. Davis Wilson, are you back? Correct.
I am back. I apologize. I called in, so hopefully that is better. And I appreciate, Dr. Davey, you adding that additional piece right there, because I think that captures what we experienced, was that there was just some voices that appeared to definitely have passion and interest in regulatory movements and regulation and what have you. However, it becomes a slippery slope, because sometimes that passion kind of oversees or trumps what's really happening, you know, boots to the ground in regulation, and that can be challenging, especially when we have an audience member of people who are they're trying to learn or trying to expand their knowledge or learn about their state. A couple of the things that I took out of it, which was interesting, I hadn't really put as much thought. We talk a lot about the licensing board themselves. And I know that we've had some conversations at the committee level, less so at a committee level, but definitely at a board level, about other laws that may govern or drive our board or committee. So take, for instance, universal recognition. Like, that is not a psychology board law, right? But that is one that we, by the nature of how it's written, we are a part of that, right? And I never really put too much thought into it. One, about how fortunate our administrative process, how we are in our administrative processes, how fortunate we are to have the structure that we have, because it was interesting listening to some of the other states as far as the role of the AG's office in those particular states and kind of what they do. I heard of one state where it's actually the AG that chairs the complaints committee, which was interesting. I've heard of there's some state laws over regulation that actually like put the financial responsibility of the AG's office. So like, we have Ms. Galvin with us, and that is a cost that the board absorbs. However, there are some states that, as part of their administrative structure, it's not a behavior analyst or psychologist or whatever, you know, nursing board or whatever board they're on. It's an actual application across all of their boards. But there are some states that actually put the cost on the complainant. So if you are, if there's a complaint opened against you, you're responsible for paying your own attorney fees, but also the attorney fees accrued by the board, which was interesting to me as far as, you know, our work and knowledge around. You know, coercion and preventing coercion and things like that. It was just very interesting to hear these administrative components. But that was what stood out to me. I think the meeting was great. I think the BACB did a great job in making sure that they were clear in the efforts of wanting to collaborate, wanting to be a part of more of these conversations. Like I said, APBA for hosting us, and I would love to see, much like Ms. Pacman, I would love to see a track that has, you know, preferably leadership that is regulators, but that can continue to move conversations like that, because I think the turnout and the conversations were great and quite informative.
Thank you, Dr. Davis Olson. Any other comments about the meeting? Okay. All right. So let's move on to the next agenda item, and that is agenda items for the next meeting. Any suggestions for that? Well, that reduces our agenda items for the next meeting. So, all right. So if there are no suggested items, we'll move on to the final agenda item, and that's adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Okay. Do I have a second?
I will second.
Any discussion? All right, all in favor, say aye.
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 Okay. All right, opposed? Okay, motion carries. All right. Enjoy your weekend, everybody.
Bye.
We'll see you.